Check this out.
It is time.
Check it out, y'all.
You are now about to witness.
And it goes a little something like this.
Alexander Ovechkin curl and drag to the back end. He scores! Simply sensational! Brodeur looking for the goal. Down the ice. Score! Bartek Brodeur!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to another edition of the Game Time Decision Podcast. This is part 3 of our hockey analytics series. We've talked to Ian Fleming about goaltending. We've talked to Sean Tierney about data visualization. Today we are talking systems. We are talking video work. And we're finally talking to someone who's played the game. It's Rachel Dorey. Rachel, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. This is fun. I like it.
I am so excited for this conversation, mostly because systems are one of those things that I adore and I'm probably incredibly, incredibly stupid about. can barely skate, terrible shot, somehow fell in love with the game, and systems are just so intriguing to me because I know so little about them. But I guess let's get right into this. We'll do the same questions that I ask everyone so far, and it's just a general overview of hockey analytics or hockey statistics. You know, where are we, where have we been, and where are we going? You know, what do you think's next?
I think hockey analytics from a numbers perspective is really in its infancy. If you look at baseball and where they are with wins and stuff like that, there's so many different numbers that you can pull from. But hockey is a bit different because it's a more flow game. So the events that can happen are just – there's so many variables. But we're tracking different things, you know, like zone entries, zone exits, passes, involvements, even things like puck battles, how involved you are with the play. So I think there's a lot of room for it to grow. But in terms of it, where it is right now, it's come so far in just, I would say, the last 4 or 5 years. And even in the past year and a half to 2 years, when you think about things like it started with Corsi and Fenwick, and now we have things like PDO and Merrick and just these new stats that are coming out. Even war is now pretty prevalent in today's analytics. So it's definitely growing, and there's a lot of room for it to improve. So I'm kind of excited to see where things go.
I am too. You mentioned a lot of tracking work, and I think that's going to be the biggest step is, you know, how impactful are passes, you know, how impactful are exits and entries. We talked a lot, Sean and I, about a guy like Justin Falk, who is just phenomenal at getting the puck out of the zone and why that makes him such a valuable defender. A lot of this is stuff that right now you can't quantify in a box score, but even in NHL play-by-play data. You know, you have to just watch the game and jot the numbers down. And that's where a lot of the work you do comes in, especially with video and systems work. So how is the relationship between video and systems? Is it a symbiotic relationship? Do you lean a lot more heavily on one versus the other? How would you describe that?
I think so. For me in particular, every team is different. So I'm blessed with the fact that one of our assistant coaches actually created this application specifically for tracking. So during the game, we will track different events, how much time you spend in your own end versus the offensive end versus the neutral zone, where the shots come from, who they come from, what kind of shot it is, and where it is in the net. So whether it's the top part of the net, the left side, the right side, five hole, that kind of thing. So we have pretty much everything. And then what we'll do is if we have a player who, let's say, is scoring a lot or not scoring but is getting the opportunities, we'll go back and we will marry the application with the video that I cut to see, okay, maybe there's tendencies developing. Maybe you're giving too much away. Is there something that we can adjust? But you kind of look for things like that. And then in terms of the system overall, if we're having issues with a breakout and we find that teams have adjusted per se, or if the team's adjusted, you'll go back and you'll look at the video and you'll see, okay, there's more breakdowns now. which will show in the zone exits, that kind of thing. So we'll look at the video and say, okay, how can we adjust our breakout to combat the adjustments that other teams have made against our breakout? And then we will look at the stats in, let's say, the next 5 or 6 games to see if there's been an improvement in controlled zone exits or completed passes, that kind of thing.
So what I'm hearing is you're using a lot more descriptive stats and then combining them with video to try and create predictable outcomes. You know, does exactly. that make sense?
Yes. Okay.
So I guess that answers my question of how you use these statistics. And I think that's really interesting to me is just the way that they're used, particularly in video, because a lot of the stats we have focus on player evaluation and on player performance and predicting how they're going to succeed or score in the future. A lot of that is based on acquiring talent and not necessarily telling you what's going on and why it's happening game to game. And I think that's something that we're always going to need system and video analysis for. Do you see sometime in the future there will be more predictive stats that we can gain from video work and from tracking projects? Or do you think those will always be more on the descriptive side of things?
I would say that you're going to move into an age where perhaps you see some predictability statistics developed. But I think kind of what I was talking about earlier with hockey being so unpredictable with all of the variables that could occur, because it's an ongoing game. It's not like baseball where it's like there's a pitch thrown and there's a number of different outcomes that can come from that. But there are outcomes, right? They're pretty cut and dry. Whereas in hockey, you could have many different things. A skater could move in a different direction, a pass could be made, a turnover, that kind of thing. So I would almost say that it would have to be descriptive, and you would have to almost react and watch for tendencies as opposed to stats that predict, because there's so many variables involved with hockey. It's a different game from that perspective. So it's hard to say whether you can predict that kind of thing.
And that's an interesting point, because the biggest thing that I find is the first challenge you face when someone who is brand new to hockey statistics or hockey analytics wants to know about something. They always ask the question, you know, but hockey's too random to measure. And you deal in a job where it's your job to measure it, and it's your job to come up with explanations for that. So how would you explain to someone who thinks that, you know, this it just isn't measurable? How would you say, well, there are things that we can do?
I would say it is measurable, but it's a different kind of measurement. It's not numbers per se. Obviously you can use numbers, and we use numbers. That's one of the ways that we measure it. But from my perspective, when we watch the video, if a player takes the same path a certain amount of times, okay, that's a tendency. How many times is that player taking that path? If a player is looking in a certain direction when he perhaps should be looking in a different direction, and that leads to turnovers, okay, well, if the player now looks in the direction we want him to, is he more successful? Is the breakout more successful? Is the play more successful? That kind of thing. So we can look at, there's so many things in video that you can look at. You can look at where the player's looking, where his stick is he leading the player? Is the player going where we want him to go within our system? Is the opponent reacting how we predict they will react under the system? Because that's how we tell our goalies to play as well. They play within the system as well. So if they're expecting pressure to force a shot, then they'll be challenging. But if we're not applying that pressure and the player gets in close, the goalie may not be as prepared for that, right? So it's a bit of a balance, I would say.
And that leads in, we've mostly covered it already, but what are the main things that you're looking at when you're tracking a game? Is it how your team is sitting positionally in a zone? Is it passes that maybe they're not making because they didn't see certain outlets? Is it decisions they have made that maybe weren't the best decision? When you're watching and when you're making these cuts, what is it that strikes out to you or stands out to you the most?
I would say everything that you just named there, stuff that I look for, it just depends on what I'm cutting the video for. So when I'm cutting video for D zone coverage or, O zone play, I'm looking at the positioning. So are the players in the right spots? Is your head looking in the right place? Is your stick in the correct passing lane, or is it available? Let's say you're in the offensive zone. Is it in a place where you're available to take a pass? Because your stick can be on the ice, but if it's not in a lane that somebody can make a pass to, then you're really not doing a lot for us. And the same can be said in the defensive zone. That's great that your stick is on the ice, but if it's not taking away a passing lane, you might as well not have it, right? So defensively, if I'm looking individually, I look at how does a player play situational? So one-on-ones, two-on-twos, is there spacing? What's their gap like? Is it do they need to close the gap? Do they need to maybe make it a little bigger? Do you lead a player where you want them to go so that allows you to kind of predict their next move? And then looking at the forwards, do you track back properly? Do you break out? Do you have good options when you break out? So do you open up maybe with your skating? Does your skating allow you to open up and get in good positions? That kind of thing. But I think generally when I'm putting a video together, I look at, do you make the simple play? Do you make the play when it's there? Or do you overcomplicate it? Where do you shoot from? Do you find the open space? That's what what Sidney Crosby does is he gets so open because he finds that open, quiet space. And we try and impress upon our players, like, if you find that open space, you're going to have your opportunity. And then there's obviously some individual stuff like the skating nuances. So how explosive are you when you skate? Is that maybe the difference as to why you're not getting opportunities? Are you good on your edges? Someone like Jeff Skinner creates opportunities because of his edge work and his skating. Can you recognize plays that are developing and anticipate what's going to happen next? Because that's a big part of the game now. So there's a lot of different things that we look at. It's just, what am I cutting the video for? Am I cutting it for systems or am I cutting it for a player?
Now, do you have methods to track, like, especially what you were talking about just after Jeff Skinner, the way to anticipate plays? Do you guys have methods in place where you can track those down? You're like, oh, F3 was spectacular today. He had four, not really takeaways or interceptions, but plays where he saw the passing lane and cut it off, or where he saw the gap and closed it. Do you guys have ways that you track that, or is it just more through video work?
That is all video work right now. We are starting to track that. That's a little bit more in the advanced side because you have to marry that with video.
Yeah.
So that falls into what I do. I will say, okay, we have a defenseman in Sudbury who is brilliant with wheeling the puck out. So he is on our power play and he'll skate the puck out brilliantly. But it's, what does he do after? Does he have a controlled zone entry? Let's say the puck is turned over. Our D-men tracking back and taking that gap away. And you'll see that with the Corsi and the shot attempts, that kind of thing. Because if you're eliminating the passing lanes and you're closing the gap, you're not going to give up as many opportunities as you would if your gap was ineffective, right? So a pairing like Jake Gardner and Connor Carrick, they're really good from a possession standpoint because both are great skaters. And if you watch them, when they are coming back and they have forward skating at them, they really use their skating to kind of guide a player into an area where they know they can attack and turn the puck over. So how many takeaways they have is one of the stats that we look at.
And that's a great, great example because growing up in Ottawa, I'm a Senators fan. I watch Erik Karlsson night in, night out. He does the same thing very, very well. But he gets the same rap as a guy like a Jake Gardner he's not good defensively, if you ask people. But the problem is, well, he is good defensively. It's just there are moves like that that aren't necessarily easy to see. It's It's actions that take away an action. And that's difficult to measure. And that's difficult to see unless you have played or unless you know to look for that specifically. Do you find when you're evaluating players or when you're trying to explain why a player does something well, it's difficult when they're taking preemptive actions like that?
Yeah, I think you picked two great examples. Jay Gardner and Erik Karlsson are two players that are they're really polarizing, especially Erik Karlsson, in the fact that a lot of people say he's not good defensively. Now, I think he gets that rap. Earlier in his career, he wasn't as good defensively. I think, personally, he's a brilliant player to watch. The problem with more Jay Gardner than Erik Karlsson is they defend differently than a Shea Weber or a Ryan Suter. And when they do take chances, so when Karlsson or Gardner skate up the ice, or maybe they make a pass that your 3, 4, 5, 6 defenseman would not be making, and it doesn't go well, those mistakes are pronounced because they normally end up in the back of the net. So the mistakes are more, they're front of mind. But I can't tell you how many times I have had a discussion with many people telling them, okay, maybe Erik Karlsson makes one of those ill-advised passes once or twice a game, but how many times does he track back and take away that opportunity with either his speed or his stick positioning? Or how many times does he create an opportunity or transition the play really well? That guy goes from offense to defense and defense to offense quicker than any defenseman I have seen in years. It is incredible to watch. So I frankly get annoyed when people don't say he's good defensively, because what he does for the Senators is it's difficult to explain. I've done some video analysis on him, and the amount of space he creates for his teammates because of how he skates and how he positions people, their entire system runs around Erik Karlsson, and not so much Jay Gardner, but he also uses his skating ability and his stick positioning to transition really well. It's just the fact that their mistakes get make the highlight reel, and all of the great plays that they make go completely unnoticed most nights. So I think that they don't get enough credit for how good they are defensively. And I think once these numbers start to leak into some of the main hockey world, they will be appreciated more.
You mentioned one defenseman who I think is equally polarizing for his defensive capabilities. That's Shea Weber. He gets a really good rap for being a strong defenseman. And then you look at his numbers and maybe they don't match up completely. And I think it is because he mentioned differently. If you ask me, and this is, I'll say what I think it is before, and you can correct me if this is totally wrong. I just think he has really bad gap control. I think he's a fine defenseman in his own end, but he is a turnstile on the blue line. And it just happens that he gets cycled on because of that. But I think he does a good job once he's in his defensive position. But that is like a complete, watch him a couple times, go, yeah, I think that's it. How would you describe maybe some of the reasons why he's so polarizing?
I think one of the reasons he's so polarizing is because of the market he plays in now.
Yep, definitely that.
In Montreal, not only do you have the English-speaking media, you have the French-speaking media, you have a TMZ type of outlet dedicated to them. Like, I have never seen anything like that. And they're really on the Shea Weber train. I've been pretty public with the fact that I don't think it was a good trade. In the long term, obviously in the short term, Shea Weber is. Yeah. He is a great defenseman. The problem with where the game is going and the type of defenseman that Shea Weber is, he's always going to have that lethal shot that's never really going to deteriorate. Chara's 38 and he still fires the puck well over 100. Shea Weber is not fleet of foot. He's not a very good skater fundamentally. And especially speed-wise, if you look at him, you look at Alexei Yemelin, that top pairing gets themselves into a lot of trouble on many nights. You look at the game against San Jose where Emelin, he looked like he was out to lunch on one of the goals. Joe Thornton, they're not able to move with the speed of the game today. And because of all of the penalties that are being called, the infractions, when you impede a player, Shea Weber's not able to be as effective. So his gap naturally has to be bigger, because if you're playing against the likes of Crosby and McDavid and Alexander Barkov and Jeff Skinner, those guys are all great skaters and they have speed. So if you have them coming down on you, they get a single step on you, it's curtains. So Weber's gap control, he gives up a lot of shots because he's focused on not allowing the players to drive to the net. And part of that is Carey Price. The Carey Price effect is something I think that is highly underrated and under talked about. Yes, he's the world's greatest goalie and it's not even close, but Shea Weber is allowed to give that gap because you're not going to beat Carey Price from 30 feet out. You're just not. So Weber is more effective as a defenseman because of his goaltender than anything else. Now, he is a great defenseman. He's just a different type of defenseman. He's not fleet of foot, but he clears out the front of the net, which, whether you like it or not, is important. Because if you see the puck, you're in the NHL, you're probably going to stop it as a goaltender. So that kind of thing is important. I just think you're absolutely bang on with the gap control, and that has to do with the fact that he's not as fleet of foot as some of the NHL's most dangerous forwards. And when you're on the number one pairing, you have to be able to combat that skill. And so that's kind of how he does it. So he's got that advantage with Carey Price.
I'll circle back on two points you made. The first was the Carey Price effect. You actually wrote a piece about that. It's on your website, thefirstpass.wordpress.com. Go and read that. It is a phenomenal piece, and I'm completely on board with it. Absolutely loved it. The second thing I wanted to talk about was you mentioned the Joe Thornton, Alexi Yamalin play against Montreal, and I think we're thinking about the same goal, the power play one. Thornton's behind the net. She's shaking her head very, very violently. From a video point of view, like, that is the perfect play to dissect, whether it be the patience Thornton has behind the net, the head fake to draw Yamalin in. I mean, that's got to be, for you, a marvel of a goal. And it's down low to up high passing, which is, again, difficult for Carey Price.
Yeah, I think Joe Thornton does not get the due that he deserves. I think that he might be one of, if not the best passers in the NHL. The opportunities that he creates, A, he's enormous, but B, the opportunity that he creates with his head fakes and the way that he deceptively handles the puck is second to none. And if you look at that play specifically with Emelin, the little stick handle nuance that he did, it made Emelin look like Bambi almost out there. Like, I couldn't believe that he did that. And you look at, once Emelin's down, he's at Thornton's mercy. And that allows Thornton to make that quick pass, and it's in the back of the net. Now, Montreal was shorthanded, but at the same time, as a defenseman, you've got to know that if you can contain Thornton from behind the net, let him stay there. It's going to be very difficult to score on Carey Price from behind the net. So if you can just leave him be, and that's where Emelin made the mistake, is he went at him.
Yeah.
And the second you go at Joe Thornton behind the net, it's you're facing off at center ice.
Marvelous, marvelous patience on that play. Before I move on, one quick question for you, because we're talking about power plays, play behind the net. It was a discussion I saw recently. It was the idea that if you are, how do I put this? If you're playing a static screen in front of the goaltender, if your man in front isn't moving around, isn't creating drama or events for the goaltender to focus on instead, is that player doing as good a job versus having that same player or a decent passer behind the goal line to stretch the defense? What would you recommend from a systems point of view if you had, you know, the players of your choosing?
I would say the 1-3-1 power play now is the new, I wouldn't say it's new, but it's the go-to
yeah.
Play now. And For me, when you're in front of the net, you've got to be doing something productive. Now you can be a static screen, but you better hope that the goaltender is static too, because if you're static and the goaltender is moving, you're no longer a screen. You're just there, and odds are if you get in the way, that goal's getting called back now. So you better be doing something darn productive if you're going to stand there. Now, I think that it is important to have a net front presence. But if you look at somebody just off the top of my head, like James Van Riemsdyk, the ability to go from being that not so much static screen, but that screen in front of the net, but to be able to pull off to the side of the goal line, not necessarily behind the net, but on the goal line, to be able to dish the puck to, let's say, a defenseman that's coming down or the forward on the far side of the ice. That opens up options. Somebody like Wayne Simmonds does that really well. While he does screen the goalie really effectively, he also tracks to the side of the net, and that makes him an option not only to pass, but to cycle the puck through. So it becomes a bit of a play in and of itself down low. But I think you have to be able to have a player that is able to screen, but is also able to recognize, hey, I have to be an option here, be a passing option. Because if Van Riemsdyk, let's say, moves down, takes a pass from Nylander off the half wall, and Nylander curls in, now Van Riemsdyk can make that pass out front, and maybe that's a better opportunity because now you're going high low, right? So you have to be able, it's all about being able to recognize and play off each other.
And having a player like a Wayne Simmonds, or I think of Joe Pavelski, I mean, it's kind of unfair because there's no one in the NHL like them when it comes to tipping pucks out of the air. It's just not fair at that point. They're too good at it, but it's the kind of player that you need. Another player who was surprisingly good in that role, that JVR style role, was Zdeno Chara. I think it was 2 seasons back. I was shocked when he was there. I can't argue with it. It worked really well. He provides a ginormous screen, but was also just so strong at dishing the puck back to Torey Krug creeping in from the blue line. But I'll move on because there is one question that I've been dying to ask you the whole time, which is if someone wants to get into tactical analysis or video work, how would they go about it? Because it's clear to me you know your stuff. I've enjoyed these conversations a ton. So if someone was looking to get into this, how would you recommend they go about doing that?
It's not a complicated answer. The first step is you gotta watch hockey, and I don't mean just sit down in front of the TV and watch hockey. You need to watch a lot of hockey. I probably watch about 6 hours of hockey a night. And it's grown now where I'll watch during the day games that I've missed the night before. But if you want to get into the tactical analysis of things, it's not just that you watch hockey, it's how you watch the hockey. Because anybody can sit in front of the TV and watch hockey. I mean, I have school friends that watch hockey and they just watch it to be a fan. Now, the big thing is if you want to get into the tactical side of things, do not follow the puck. So you just, for the first little while, until you get used to it, you don't follow the puck. You pick a player and you watch their movements, the entire shift, and where they are relative to the play. So let's say you want to analyze the center within a system. Don't pay attention to where the puck is. Watch the center. So if you want to watch somebody like Joe Pavelski, somebody like Austin Matthews, somebody, even Mark Scheifele, plays within the Winnipeg Jets system really well. You track them the whole shift, and yes, track where they are relative to the puck, but track how close they are to their players and the support that they provide. That kind of thing. So you start small by just tracking a player and then you build. So now let's say the team goes on the power play or the team goes on the penalty kill. Often I would pause the TV when the team would be set up and I would look at where they were and then I would look into where the defense was. And then the next power play, I would look to see if there were any adjustments. And the same goes for the penalty kill. Now you can build on that and say, okay, now you look at the power play zone entries. And now we have the drop pass that was kind of started with Patrick Kane. And you look at how the players fit in there. That's more down the line. But then you can look at things like D-zone positioning. So how are players positioned in their own end? Are they pressuring? Where are their sticks in the passing lanes? Are they giving up certain shots to not allow other shots? So if you look at when the Leafs play the Penguins, there was a 5-on-3 for 2 minutes, and the Leafs did a good job of taking away the passing lanes to only allow Justin Schultz to shoot because they didn't want Crosby, Malkin, Kessel shooting, right? So it's looking at things like that and not following the puck. So it's all about where are players, where are they relative to their teammates, are they where they're supposed to be? And then once you figure that part out, it becomes relatively easy to sort of analyze the power play and the PK and the D-zone positioning and the breakouts. You learn to recognize it pretty quickly and the little adjustments that players make, which is what makes players so dangerous, is their ability to adjust within the system.
That's a fantastic answer. If you want a great read on especially PK analysis, you can go to Rachel's website, thefirstpass.wordpress.com. She has a fantastic piece up there analyzing the Carolina Hurricanes penalty kill system. It is phenomenal. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is a fantastic piece. One last question for you. If you could change one tactical thing in the NHL that you see that either bothers you, or you could say, guys, we need to focus more on one idea. We need to take a deeper look at whether that is passing, whether it's spacing, whether it's, you know, something I'm not thinking of, puck velocity even. What would you suggest or change and why?
One of the things actually that our team is starting to track is the first pass. Ironically enough, that's what the blog is called. But we look at the first pass, and by first pass, I mean, your breakout pass. So your defenseman generally is going to be making that first pass. And they talk about it. Bob McKenzie talks about it a lot. Oh, this defenseman makes a great first pass, right? Well, what does that mean? Okay. So the stat that I'm looking at now is, how does your first pass correlate to a controlled zone exit, controlled offensive zone entry, and further to that, a scoring chance? So if you make a good first pass to a player that's in stride, does not have to slow down when he accepts the pass and he can go, does that correlate to an offensive zone entry and a scoring chance? And then you look at the other side of things, is if it's not a clean first pass, so it's either a turnover or the player's got to stop, the entire breakout is messed up at that point, you've got to start over again. But how often does that lead to a turnover and a scoring chance against? So you're looking at two sides of things, but it's all centered around that one pass, that type of thing. So that's a stat that I'm looking at. In terms of system-wise, I'm a big believer in the aggressive penalty kill, so like the Hurricanes. But you have to have specific player personnel to be able to do that. I really like it. I'm a fan of Bill Peters' systems. And I think that today, with the skill in the league and the amount of penalties being called, you have to stop the entry and force the skilled players to operate at a higher level by being aggressive. So if you just give up the zone, you're probably going to give up scoring chances. But if you force the skilled players to use their skill at maybe a speed that they're not comfortable with, you might have more success turning the puck over, let's say on the penalty kill, or even strength. So that's kind of a tactical change that I like, is the aggression, the ability to anticipate and read the play.
On the offensive side of the puck, those are two things that Connor McDavid and Crosby do so incredibly well, is changing speed on the fly. And it turns defenders into pylons. They just can't adjust for it.
No.
You mentioned Bill Peters. reminded me of a question I had for you that I totally forgot to ask. Bill Peters has an interesting philosophy where he works heavily with statistics, but he doesn't tell his players those statistics. He just coaches them his way. Do you agree with it? Do you think maybe he's under-trusting his players' ability to receive that information? Or do you think, you know what, he knows his guys, he knows how they react, and, you know, that information is for him, and then he can use that information to coach them?
I like it. Do I think that sharing the statistics with your players is a good thing? Absolutely. But they're not always going to maybe understand where you're coming from, and you also don't want to overload them with information, because who as Bill Peters or anybody to tell Sidney Crosby how he's going to create an opportunity? Sidney Crosby is going to create an opportunity all on his own. He's going to be just fine. However, within the system, Bill Peters, without sharing those statistics, can adjust his system to his players' strengths and weaknesses. And that's one thing that I don't think he gets enough credit for, is he has made defensemen like Jacob Slavin and Brett Pesce, Ron Hainsey, look amazing in their system because of how he uses them, right? So he doesn't necessarily have to share those statistics with them. As long as he adjusts and gives them a reason, hey, you'll be more effective by doing X, Y, or Z, I don't think it's necessary to share all of the information.
I like it. And you're right, Bill Peters, you're not going to get any arguments from me. He is one of my favorite coaches in the league. He does a phenomenal job down in Carolina. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a fantastic conversation. I have been enthused, enthralled. So much knowledge that you've shared. I'm just soaking it in. I cannot express enough thanks. If you want to check Rachel out, you can do that at Dory88 on Twitter, at The First Pass. You can check out her website, thefirstpass.wordpress.com. All of that will be linked in the description down below. I highly recommend you go read that stuff. You'll be better off for doing that. If you want to follow the podcast, check us out online at GTD_podcast. You can check out myself at Colton Prail on Twitter. If you like this, all of the episodes are up on lastwordonhockey.com. We have two other episodes, like I mentioned, Sean Tierney talking about data visualization and Ian Fleming on goaltender statistics. Next week, we're going to have Matt Kane on talking about hockey statistics in academia. It is very exciting. I'm excited to do it. That's pretty much it. So have a good one, and I will see you next week.